We would like to acknowledge that the land which we are gathered on today is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe Nation, specifically the Chippewa Tri-Council, comprised of the Chippewas of Beausoleil, Rama, and Georgina Island First Nations, and more recently, the Mississaugas of the Credit River First Nation. Ontario is covered by 46 treaties and other agreements and is home to many Indigenous nations from across Turtle Island, including the Inuit and the Métis. These treaties and other agreements, including the One Dish with One Spoon Wampum Belt Covenant, are agreements to peaceably share and care for the land and its resources. Other Indigenous nations, Europeans, and newcomers were invited into this covenant in the spirit of respect, peace, and friendship. Most of us have come here as settlers, immigrants, or newcomers in this generation or generations past. We are all treaty people. Every day, we are mindful of broken covenants and we strive to make this right. We commit to collaborating based on the foundational assumption that Indigenous peoples have their power, strength, and competency to develop culturally specific strategies for their communities. We are dedicated to honoring Indigenous self-determination, history, and culture, and are committed to moving forward in the spirit of reconciliation and respect with all First Nation, Métis, and Inuit people. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Beyond the Stethoscope, a podcast focused on hospice palliative care. My name is Linda Meeks, and I'm one of the education facilitators for the North Simcoe Muskoka Hospice Palliative Care Network. Today, our other facilitator, Laura Bates, will be hosting the session, and she will be interviewing and speaking with Jen Kerr, who is the Grief and Bereavement Counselor at Matthews House and a caregiver consultant in her own business. So welcome, Laura, and welcome, Jen. Laura, I'll hand over to you.
Thanks, Linda. Thank you, Jen, for joining us today. We are going to be talking today about death and dying, or dying and death, depending on how you want to phrase it. And Jen and I will talk about that a little bit later, about how much we love and don't love the words associated with hospice palliative care. The title of our podcast today is Polite People Don't Say Death, because in today's culture, especially in North America, death is a bit of a bad word. So we're going to see if we can break down some of those stereotypes and some of those stigmas that come along with it and help make it a normal part of your professional and personal conversations. Welcome, Jen. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So remind us where you are in the hospice palliative care realm. I'm a nurse and you are not. So this is going to be interesting.
That's right. So my actual designation is a registered social service worker. So I actually just recently completed a Bachelor of Applied Sciences in Family Counseling. So I have been working in the hospice palliative care world for just over 3 years now. So as a counselor, but before that, I was doing a lot of patient navigation and care coordination. So I should say that I've been in the hospice palliative world probably for over 10 years now. So I've seen it on both sides.
That's awesome. I've been a registered nurse for 10 years and all of my practice has been in some degree in the hospice palliative care world. So I also feel like sometimes I've seen and heard it all. So I want to talk first about how we dealt with death and dying or illness 100 years ago or more. A lot has changed in the 1900s, but prior to this, things looked a lot different. You didn't go to hospital to get well. You went to hospital to die. Mm-hmm. And the most people who used hospitals were the poor. Hospitals were set up as charities, usually by religious affiliations and organizations, where the poor could go for treatment, food, shelter. Think, you know, Oliver Twist, Victorian England, where they were not clean, they were not sanitary, and you did not go there with an expectation that you were going to survive and come home. This is also the time before antibiotics, proper hygiene, sterilization, little or no sanitation, no sewage disposal systems, and definitely no clean drinking water. So you can imagine that most people died, if not by accident or some sort of catastrophic event, that they died because of disease that was infectious. So I actually found a statistic, and in the early 1920s, of the top 8 causes of death in Canada, 5 of them were because of acute disease from infectious causes. So 5 of the top 8, that's a lot. If you compare that to today, in the top 9 causes of death in 2018, only one of them is from an infectious cause, and that's influenza and pneumonia. Isn't that crazy?
Wow. It's hard to think about that now, right? Especially with everything.
And even before Medicaid and, you know, government-run hospitals that were funded by the government, there were a few specialized hospitals, but they were for places like tuberculosis or the quote-unquote mental hospitals of the olden day, where people were institutionalized because they didn't fit into society somehow. And until the advent of antibiotics, really, if you were told you had an infectious disease, it was a death sentence.
Yeah, it was to be expected.
Yeah. And looking into the research that I did at that time, unless you ended up in a hospital or because you were institutionalized, death primarily occurred at home. And if you were rich enough, you had the care of a doctor or a private nurse of some sort, but you were still at home surrounded by your friends and family, obviously except for the case of wars or accidents. There was a lot more community involvement. When somebody died, everybody in the local community knew about it.
Yeah.
There was lots of religious or cultural rituals that involved the greater community, and it was a much more public event. If it was a small town, for example, often the entire town would stop to either watch the funeral procession or attend the funeral itself. Businesses were closed, normal activities stopped, everybody gathered to support that family when somebody died. Not much has changed in terms of our rituals, but we seem to be more disconnected these days. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. It's much more disconnected. And the thought, like how you're explaining that back then, it seems like it was really normalized for a long period of time, like you said, to have the community come together, that there was, again, there was an expectation that everybody had to come together to support the family, right? And so even hearing that, how normal that sounds during that, you know, during that decade, how we've come so far from that now.
Yeah, death was much more familiar. It wasn't hidden from anybody of a specific age or stage. The attitudes towards dying meant that it wasn't shrouded in silence or hidden from public view.
Right. Right.
And when you look at things today, it wasn't until the mid-1900s when medical advances brought sort of the modern medicine realm to us. Antibiotics, different treatments, different screening methods were invented. And the post-war period witnessed a growth in the number of hospitals and an increase in the training and specialization of healthcare workers. It wasn't until after World War II that you saw specialists in specific areas of medicine, even. Up until then, a doctor was a doctor and you treated everybody in any type of disease.
Right.
It's also interesting if you look at the statistics of where people have died. So as I alluded to before, death often happened at home more than 100 years ago. There weren't hospitals, hospices, all those things that we have today. The peak happened in 1994, when 77% of Canadian deaths took place in a hospital. That's a lot of people.
Oh, wow.
We've shifted from not knowing how to treat people to fixing people. I like to say that modern medicine is an awful lot like the anti-aging and pop culture of stay young, be young, look young. Western medicine is about treating and fixing.
Absolutely. That was really well put. It very much bundles together. Yeah.
The thought in the early 1950s, especially with the advent of antibiotics, was that we were limitless in our ability to manage and cure disease, that we could fix anybody from anything. Death was almost considered a medical failure.
Yes.
Because the idea was that we could fix people.
Yeah.
Often the care of the dying person in a hospital was left to nurses who were not trained or equipped to care for a dying person. They had been taught also to save lives, treat illness, and prevent death. They were not taught how to care for the dying or how to provide any sort of hospice palliative care to a terminally ill or dying person. Another thing that I noticed in my research is that death went from a family event to a grown-up only and very rigorous restrictions in it too. I remember in the 1980s when my younger brother was hospitalized to have his tonsils out, although it was a day, you know, a standard procedure and he was well and there were no complications, I, as his older sister, was not allowed to visit because I was under 12. And that was the norm in a lot of hospitals for a very long time, that children were not welcome around ill people. Could you imagine being a child whose parent was dying and went to the hospital? You'd never be able to see them again.
Yeah. Yeah.
It just, it astounds me. I see today a lot of segregation between normal people, and I put normal in a quotation mark, you know, the regular everyday people and famous people. We don't observe the death of anybody unless they're our immediate family, unless they're someone famous or a statesperson. If you think about when sports stars or politicians have passed away, whether it was from old age and illness or unexpectedly in an accident, the amount of community outpouring of grief and support that comes with that. We don't do that for regular folk anymore, unless it's your immediate family. The other thing that I've noticed is that because the greater community and people are not present during dying or at the time of death, it's become very mysterious and almost feared. It's human nature for us to fear what's unknown or strange. And where we fear, when we fear something, we begin to believe myths and assumptions that aren't necessarily true.
Yes.
What are your thoughts about this so far, Jen? I wonder if you've noticed this sort of shift in your practice as a in the counseling world.
Absolutely. So it's really neat because I, of course, speak to the other side of it. Being on the counseling side of things, we have more of those emotional conversations with the patients or with their family members. And one of the biggest things that we find that it's so difficult to navigate a conversation around is, first of all, the advanced care planning part. Right. So even working with caregiver support, as soon as the topic of death and dying comes up, of what their wishes might be when it comes to, you know, how they want to die, right? Do they want to have a celebration of life? Do they want to have a funeral? All these conversations that, yes, as we as practitioners have normalized, and it's easy to have those conversations. But out in the community, it's still, like you said, it's very taboo, right? So in the way that hospitals, even over the years, have become a place where illnesses are supposed to be cured, right? We're supposed to have the advanced medicine in order to be able to get people to, you know, come back, right? To be able to manage symptoms and make them live longer. However, we've, like you said, in the hospitals, they're pushing away from those conversations about how do we start preparing for end of life, right? So having those types of conversations for us is really interesting because they very much look at us like we're rushing it, right? Like, well, how dare you start this conversation now? Because I'm not ready for that. My loved one's not ready for that. Why are we talking about this, right? And this,
I found that too, that you could have even the very person who was dying themselves actively dying very close to death. We're talking days to a week or two, sleeping more than 20 hours a day, minimal intake.
Yes.
And from a healthcare perspective, We know that person is getting close to death, but sometimes they can't even say that they're dying out loud.
Exactly. Exactly.
And I know there are some cultural and religious limitations on these types of conversations that, you know, there are people who believe that having these types of conversations will cause a person to lose hope, possibly give up and die faster, those sorts of things. But I do believe that there has to be at least some acknowledgement amongst the people involved that what's going on is what we're seeing. And, you know, it's sad when you have people who are upset that, you know, modern medicine has let them down.
Exactly. Exactly. And again, it falls back on the healthcare system too, right? That they failed. And I think it's just so powerful to be able to normalize those conversations beforehand, right? And I think that's where it comes from. Like, we step in to when they, yes, they are palliative, and, you know, they're in within days or weeks of dying, but yet these conversations are only happening then. And that's where I have the issue in my field, because that's kind of where I step in and have those conversations. But it shouldn't be a crisis conversation, right? It should not be a crisis conversation. It should be something that we have normalized way ahead of time. Like, even when you're deciding who your POA, also known as power of attorney, right? So even when you're having that discussion, okay, who do I want to be my power of attorney? So in that discussion should also be talking about the death and dying, right? Or sorry, dying and death. We need to have those discussions. We need to have those discussions, because again, by doing that, by blending all those topics together, you're just talking about a normal part of life.
Exactly. Right?
That's what's happening there.
Exactly. Yeah. And I've noticed, and I'm sure you've come across this too, there's a bit of a disconnect. There's often nobody actually comes right out and teaches caregivers or family what to look for, what to expect prior to the dying person reaching this end of life stage. And I don't know whether it comes from the fear of talking about it too early, or the stigma of being morbid and this is taboo, and if it's not happening, we don't need to deal with it yet. But I think for many people, having these conversations earlier normalizes what to expect, and it again keeps it from becoming a crisis.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's interesting that you say that, because again, from my side of things, what the the common reason for that is actually the patients are usually protecting their family members. So in I used to also work at another hospice, that Hospice George and Triangle in Collingwood. And in that, what I was really grateful for is I actually worked in the back with the patients and family members as a patient and family support worker, and having those and seeing those conversations happen, you can see that the family members are the ones, you know, kind of tiptoeing around, you know, what to do next. And, you know, having those one-on-one conversations, you know, taking the time to look through photos together and having, you know, those real raw conversations that I think should be happening in the room, but yet they're still fixating on medications. They're still fixating on services. When can they go home? Or can they eat? And they're so focused on that caregiver mentality that they lose sight of what they should really be doing in that time that they have with their loved ones. So when I was working in the back, I would encourage families to have those conversations, right? Now is your time to say things that maybe you wanted to say before and you haven't yet, right? And to do some life review, right? Talking about everything that they've been through together. Those are quality conversations that I encourage patients and families to have. But what ends up happening is, because the patients are usually scared to bring it up, right? They can't say, listen, like, I'm dying, you know, and it's okay. We can have these conversations. But so because of that taboo feeling around dying and death, then it really interrupts what that grieving process is supposed to be. And that's where, when even as a counselor working in grief and bereavement, we talk about this all the time, right? I have clients who say, I just wish I spent my time talking about real things, rather than fixating on the medical component of it.
And it is very hard in the moment to get out of that headspace, especially when you've been a primary caregiver. And that, I think, is a whole other podcast.
Yes, it is.
Because if our system allowed people the time and space to just be, it might be a little bit easier. But as I said, that's a whole other podcast. I also hate that there's a stigma that goes along with hospice palliative care, grief and bereavement, dying, death, the word hospice palliative care, you know, terminal illness, all of those not so nice words. But because they're stigmatized, it becomes a courtesy stigma, which was a term I had never heard of before until I did some research for our conversation. And a courtesy stigma is the things or people associated with a stigmatized concept that automatically become stigmatized because they have a connection. And I found that interesting because, you know, we've done a pretty good job about increasing our awareness and our ability to talk about some of these tough conversations, especially in hospice palliative care in the last 20 years. But I often, you know, when somebody asks what I do and I say, well, I'm a hospice palliative care nurse. Oh, and you can almost see people take a half step back, like it's contagious.
Yes.
And I'm catching.
Yes.
Guess what? I'm a normal person. Well, that's debatable, but that's okay. I like to say to people, you know, it really is an honor. There are two big journeys that we take in this life. One of them is our birth and one of them is our death. And I think that they both deserve an equal amount of love, respect, planning, preparation, honor, all of those things, because they're both monumental. They both deserve the recognition that they are a monumental journey.
100%. 100%. And I have to say the same thing. And that's one of the explanations I use with my clients quite regularly is, you know, when the topic comes up and it's treated as though it's taboo and it's stigmatized, you know, I try to use that reference, you know, just as you would if you're welcoming a life into the world with, you know, the amount of community that comes together, right? And how it's celebrated, how it's recognized. Why wouldn't we do the same thing when we leave, right?
And it's exactly.
Yeah.
Can you speak a little bit about the sort of medicalization of grief and bereavement? I know from the nursing perspective, you know, we're taught that if somebody hasn't quote unquote dealt with their grief in about 6 months, it becomes a diagnostic disorder.
Yes, good old DSM.
And I don't understand how we still put a timeline on grief when it is completely normal that it's not the same for everybody.
Yes.
Why do we still put people in boxes, Jen?
That is an excellent question. And I'm still working on that one too. But from what I've seen, and it's really interesting too, because of course, the amount of clients that I've seen over the years, that is one of the very common patterns that you see the common questions that come up is like, well, it's been 6 months, or I mean, it's been a year. Why do I feel like I'm not getting better? I have clients ask me that on the daily, right? And that's where that is coming from. The root of that is very much how we've stigmatized grief, or, you know, we're educated in schools. I forgot the psychologist's name, but it's the common stages of what grief is supposed to be, right? You've got your anger.
Kubler-Ross.
Thank you. Kubler-Ross.
Yes.
Kubler-Ross.
Who coincidentally did not write those specifically about bereavement.
Oh, okay. See, I didn't even know that.
So from my understanding, the way we've interpreted her work is not quite how she meant it to be.
which is really awful when you come to think about it, because it has very much normalized into what we consider grief to be. So when people can put them in boxes and stages, it makes more sense to us, right? Because like, okay, you know, we just have to go through these stages. Just like if you broke your arm, you wear a cast and then you wear, you know, a brace. And like, those are the stages you're supposed to go through when you break an arm. Well, people want to think about grief kind of the same way, that we're supposed to go through these stages until we heal. And so it's really neat kind of working in this field, because you have to break those patterns, right? You kind of have to put them in reverse. And I joke around with my clients all the time. I'm like, I'm going to say things that you're probably going to not like, right? Because, you know, a lot of my clients think that, well, because I'm crying, or because I feel angry, or because I don't feel like talking to anybody, I'm grieving the wrong way. I'm not getting better. Right. And I always say, I'm going to tell you something right now. By you expressing that, by crying, by screaming into a pillow, by telling people, I can't talk to you right now, that is you actually healing, right? You're actually doing the work by allowing yourself an outlet, right? You're actually doing the work, and you think that you're not doing it because that's not what society has taught us, right? So kind of having to redo all the education in what people think that grief and bereavement is supposed to be is, it can be draining, but it's also really rewarding, because it's so, you can actually see the relief that a lot of my clients will have when they think, oh my gosh, it's okay to express it. Right? It's okay to set boundaries.
To not be okay.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
And you're right. You know, we get told, here's the stages. They're linear. You follow the list. And once you've checked one stage off, you're not supposed to go back.
That's right.
They forget to tell you, you know, culture, society, whatever, that it's not linear. It's circular. They overlap.
Yes.
You can go back and forth between them for days, months, weeks, years, decades, even. And we've normalized getting over things, being strong, you know, the British stiff upper lip, however you want to say it, whatever term you want to use. We've made the people who grieve and recover quicker than normal.
Yes.
Whereas they're actually on the short end of a very much larger spectrum.
Yes.
And you hear people who are grieving 5 or 6 or 10 or 20 years later. And as a healthcare worker, until I had experienced my own personal grief, I thought was a little extreme. I was like, you know.
Yeah.
But grief doesn't have a timeline.
No, it doesn't.
And every person's timeline is different. And every grief response is different. So you and I, if we lost our child, you know, heaven forbid, our grief for that would be very much different than if a pet died.
Yes.
Or we lost a job we loved unexpectedly. You know, if we are attached to something, we are going to grieve the loss of that attachment.
Yeah.
But every attachment will be a different process. And I think, you know, people see somebody whose spouse has died 10 years later, still, you know, honoring their birthday and their wedding anniversary and such, and thinking that's strange, but that's not, and it shouldn't be considered strange.
No. And that kind of reminds me too of, because this is something too that can be an entirely different podcast, because I love to speak to it. And I always joke about how I would love to facilitate seminars for people who are dealing with somebody who is actively grieving on what to say, what to do. Because one of the common things that I deal with in my work too is having clients who tell me, you know, I don't know how to say no to people, and I really do, or that I do really need support. I do need help, but I have my friends and family saying, call me if you need anything. And we, again, as a culture, have really much normalized cliche things to say, What is the normal, what are you supposed to say when somebody's lost a loved one, right? So things like they're in a better place now. They're no longer suffering. Call me if you need anything, right? And these are things that, yes, they come with good intention. However, are they practical for someone who is actively grieving? Not so much. So
no,
it's not.
You're asking someone who can't make a decision about what socks to put on.
That's right.
To make the decision to call a friend and say they need help.
Exactly. The type of people.
That's a lot to ask.
It is. And the type of people that they might need are someone who says, I'm coming over Tuesday. I'm just going to come in and check in, see what you need. Like if you need some food, you know, they tell you, this is what I'm going to do for you. So that now relieves the pressure of that person who's grieving to say, oh no, I need to make a point to call this person because I actually do need help. Right. Yeah. So things like that, that kind of brought that up for me when you were talking about that, because I think it's so important that we as a community, again, know what it is that someone really needs when they are grieving. Right. And until you've been through it yourself, a lot of times you don't know what to do.
Yeah. And I kind of liken it to the movement with pregnancy and birth, where there was an acknowledgement that women who are pregnant and having young babies and young families have been disconnected from their support systems.
Yes.
You know, we don't live in a community with our aunts and our mothers and our grandmothers. And we've seen a lot of disconnect and the results of that disconnect in not having that tangible support in those early days.
Yeah.
You know, incidences of postpartum depression and everything are on the rise because women are trying to do it alone. And I think the same thing happens when people are grieving.
Yes.
If you don't have an immediate community, whether it's family or friends or a religious organization that you're affiliated with, you don't have those people who can come over and cook a meal or drop off a meal, clean your house, watch your children, sweep the floor so that you can actually spend the time doing what you need to do to grieve, whether it's sitting quietly, whether it's being active, whether it's curled up in a ball in the shower crying, you know, whatever it happens to be. We don't have that support system for people to do that. And we're expected to be strong and to get through these things with the minimal amount of outside support.
Yes.
So I think also when people, you know, are good intentioned and say, call me if you need anything, we're almost setting people up to fail from that statement alone because they don't want to call because they don't want to be seen as weak or unable to cope.
Yeah.
Or a burden for sure. We expect people to get over these things quickly and they can't.
No.
Which is a pet peeve of mine. And I know you and I in preparing for this, we talked a lot about how the wording around palliative care, death, dying, grieving, we do a lot of euphemisms and cliches. And, you know, I think it's even for medical personnel and healthcare people, we have trouble saying someone has died sometimes.
Yes.
We say, you know, I'm sorry, they're gone.
I'm sorry for your loss.
I'm sorry for your loss. Someone has passed away. Or even the good old telling kids that somebody's gone to sleep.
Yeah. Or on vacation.
Yeah. Really? You've heard that
one? Oh, that's a common one I hear all the time too. They're gone on vacation. And it reminds me of that scene from Forrest Gump when the mom's telling Forrest that he's gone on vacation. And I'm like, are we really doing that?
I can't say I've heard that one, but I've definitely heard, you know, gone to sleep. I know in some religious communities, and I speak from experience, you know, so-and-so has gone to be with Jesus or gone to be with God or gone to heaven, which if those are your beliefs is great, but you have to die to do that.
Yeah.
And in my own family, I have a few extended family of an older generation who use a lot of these euphemisms, and I just respond with, so they died. And they look at me.
Yep.
Like I asked them if I had 5 heads and 25 eyes.
Yes.
Yeah. So I think if as healthcare workers, if we can make sure we are using encompassing, correct, plain language, it will help those who are not medical people that much more.
Yes.
It's not going to help somebody if we aren't using words that encourage openness and normalization of these topics. So I wonder, Jen, if like me and a few other palliative care nurses that I know, are you the weird one at family dinners that talks about strange things like advanced care planning and what you want if you're dying?
Yes, very much so. And I never notice it until somebody brings it up and, you know, they have to joke around like, okay, Jen, simmer it down. Let's please talk about what's on Netflix. We do not need to talk about this right now. Right. And because we've become so accustomed to it and we normalize it and we're obviously passionate about it. Right. But you do, you know, I think it's important to be that annoying person at the dinner table sometimes to help normalize that topic.
I agree.
Yeah,
I am known maybe slightly in a bad way as the lady who talks about what she does for work, but not in a good way.
Right.
They've all been handed advanced care planning booklets and information from me, whether they're well or not.
Yeah.
And maybe 5 years ago, I wouldn't have been quite so bold, but I've discovered that I'm not doing anybody in my practice or my personal life any favors by not just saying, here's the elephant in the room and here's its name. We're not going to paint its toenails and hide it in the corner so it blends in.
Yes.
We're going to say, this is what it is. They've gotten used to me over the years. They still kind of roll their eyes when, you know, once or twice a year, I look at my in-laws and say, so has anything changed about your advanced care planning? Or, you know, some great aunt has died and we're talking about the funeral or the illness. And I was like, so what do you think? What would your choices be if that was you in this situation?
Yeah.
So they're getting used to me. And honestly, I think I know my father-in-law has expressed his thanks that it was things that they hadn't discussed even in their own marriage. And I'm not that young. My in-laws and my parents are not that young anymore. And they're starting to be in that, you know, age and stage where their friends and their family members are getting ill and and dying.
Yeah.
I almost said passing away.
Yeah. It's easy, right? It's because we're so used to it, even as practitioners that have normalized it and put the work into it. It's something that almost comes out naturally in our vocabulary sometimes, but we're the ones who, you know, will catch it. Right. And I think that's what's important.
Yep. And I come from families that didn't talk about difficult subjects. So I've been a bit of a trailblazer, much to their dismay. However, I know that, you know, as my mom's power of attorney for personal care, I need to know those kinds of decisions.
Yes.
And values and what she would want in different situations. And yeah, I think we do need to do all that we can to normalize these types of discussions so that our kids will grow up not fearing the tough topics.
Yes. Yes.
I know you have a younger child. My son is now 15 and I went back to nursing school when he was 2.5. So me being a nurse is very normal for him. And he used to like to help by looking through the anatomy textbook and at all the fun pictures as I was studying. When I worked in a residential hospice, was told in an age and stage appropriate way what hospice was.
Yeah.
And what I did when I went to work. And it was never hidden. And I think because it's always been a normal thing to talk about in our family,
mm-hmm.
it's not a strange and scary thing for him. He has visited elderly relatives in the active dying phase. And personally, I think that it's important for kids to be told and exposed to things in an age and stage appropriate way.
Agreed.
So that they can grow up and be okay with these conversations when it's important.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And I've done the same thing with, I mean, again, my daughter, you know, she's three going on 13 right now, but even, you know, during at my time at the hospice in Collingwood, I would do the same where I would take the time to take her to visit. And even during COVID, we would come to the patient's windows just to say hi, right? And I needed her to see that. I needed her mm-hmm. to see that, yeah, they're an actively dying process. And I would explain to her when she asked me what I do. And there was times, I think at the beginning, I was doing the same thing where I would just say, simplify it to say, mommy helps people. But then I realized, kind of caught myself saying that and not being specific and almost kind of, you know, protecting her from the topic of death. And then mm-hmm. I started to correct myself over time and say exactly what I did. Right. And she didn't bat an eye. She didn't ask a question. And so, you know, and I think that's really important even from an early age, to normalize it in a way that they see it as a part of life, that this is just what it is. Right. And it is so important.
Jen, have you found things in your work or your personal life that you've used to help normalize these types of conversations? I know at the Palliative Care Network here, we run something called Death Over Dinner, and it's a movement where we bring people together over a meal or a snack and a drink, and sort of prompt those conversations about advanced care planning, who you would want with you at end of life, where would you want to die, whether it's home, hospital, or hospice, or other, that sort of thing. And I know for myself, that's been a really good way to introduce the idea to people from a professional standpoint. What about you?
Yeah, so in the world of hospice, on my side of things, what I find to be, well, one of the most beneficial things is the support groups. So one of the groups that I've run is the caregiver support group. And in those conversations, that's where I find it's kind of my opening or my gateway to start that conversation, right? Start to normalize the end of life planning. And I've definitely had clients over the years where they will, you know, they'll put their hands up in the group and be like, oh no, I didn't, this isn't what I signed up for, right? I didn't sign up to talk about death, right? They very much kind of want to talk about how to cope with the healthcare system navigation. They want to cope with just the caregiver burnout, right? They only want specific mm-hmm. things to benefit from in those conversations. And you know what? And I'll say, you know, I support the fact that they're uncomfortable and this might not be the group for them. However, it doesn't stop me from bringing that topic up because it is all part of it, right? Even the anticipatory yeah. grief that a lot of people don't even know that they're going through it, you know, again, that's part of that bigger conversation. So I find that the caregiver yeah. support groups are a fantastic way to, you know, to start those topics.
And I imagine for some of them, if they haven't had the conversation with the person they're caring for yet,
yes.
it might be what sparks the conversation between those two people exactly. to make sure that the wishes and values are followed.
Yes. Yes.
One thing I did notice on the weekend when I was shopping is I was in a big bookstore chain, and the self-help section seems to be getting bigger and bigger.
Yes, it is.
we've you know, gone away from fiction and literature and, you know, easy reading to how to fix, help, cure, prevent everything possible yes. under the sun. And then I noticed that the terminal illness, chronic illness, death, dying, bereavement, grief section, it's there, but it's still hidden at the back.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Covered in cobwebs.
Or if not even cobwebs, you're looking around as you enter the aisle going, does anybody know what I'm looking at?
Yeah.
It's yep. like when you're looking for relationship help, but you don't want to admit that, you know, you need some counseling or whatever there. And you tiptoe into the aisle, grab the first book you see and out you go.
Yeah.
Cause you don't want anybody to know what you're looking for.
That's right.
It's everywhere. We're denying how normal it is everywhere.
Yes. Yes, we are. It's a problem. And I like that you brought the bookstore up because again, there's, you know, there's a lot of people who will ask, you know, what kind of books they should be reading, as in to see, okay, like, how do I prepare for grief? Or is this going to teach me how to grieve properly? And this kind of goes back to what we were saying before, that there are a lot of, and don't get me wrong, there are a lot of books that are extremely helpful in regards to normalizing death and dying, and talking about you know, the rawness of it and what to kind of expect. And those are books I will recommend. However, there are a lot of books out there that kind of similar to that Kubler-Ross mentality of, you know, how you're supposed to grieve and the stages and everything like that. And, you know, and those are books that I try to, you know, get my clients to stay away from, because it, like you said before, it's everybody grieves so differently and it's not linear. Mm-hmm. Right. And there's no real stages. It's how you emotionally respond to that experience. Right. So if it's a pet, if it's a spouse, if it's a child, if it's a coworker, we're going to respond differently to those deaths because there's different relationships there. So it is, yes, there's things that you can learn and you can take away from, but there is no control or no guideline as to how we're going to respond to a certain death.
Yeah. And I think it's our human nature that we want to classify things and contain things into groupings, or, you know, knowing the pattern that to expect. We don't like the unknown. We don't like things that don't follow the rules.
Yes. We don't like to be uncomfortable. We do not like to be uncomfortable.
Whether it's physically or emotionally.
Yes.
You're right. We don't. I do think that we've done some good work in the last 10 to 15 years in terms of bringing these topics to a forefront, but we definitely have some room to grow. That's for sure.
100% agreed.
I'm just thinking about the people who are listening to us. How do you think, whether they're a healthcare provider or just a member of the general public, how do you think they can work to normalize discussions about dying or death or palliative care or any of these topics, either in their personal lives or their professional lives?
That's a great question. I think that the first thing that came to mind was having the medical staff, so your nurses, your physicians, your PSWs, collaborating more with the therapists, right? Collaborating more with the social workers, because those conversations, like you said, there's still doctors in the hospitals who still are afraid to say they're dying. Right. And mm-hmm. So to be able to kind of blend those conversations to say, like, you know, this is what we work with on our side of things. This is how we bring the topic up. This is our vocabulary that we use. Right. Then being able to kind of collaborate that way, I think really does help in being able to normalize that conversation. But also it's coming from somebody that patients and families really look up to, like such as a physician or a nurse, right? They want to hear what you have to say, right? So if they feel that they're not normalizing the topic or they're being taboo about it, then it's making them feel like they can't be comfortable with it. So I think, and vice versa, right? Us as therapists, we need to know more about the medical vocabulary and what to expect. A big thing, again, working in residence with patients and family members was them being frustrated over their loved ones not being able to eat, right? And so I know why they can't, but you guys are the one that can explain exactly why, you know, the aspiration and everything. There's only minimal things I can speak to with that. I think what's the beautiful thing about hospice is that we're all able to do that. We're all able to work together, and it's such a beautiful you know, synchrony of us being able to come in, have those conversations, but then Laura would come in after me and be like, this is why this is happening. So you're getting a full circle of care in hospice and in palliative care by that happening, but it's not so much the same out in the community, right? When somebody has a physician coming in saying one thing, and then they have a counselor coming in from somewhere else and saying another thing, and nobody's kind of on that same page. So I think what's really important that we do kind of follow that hospice mentality and work together as again, as practitioners and being able to make sure we're having those same conversations.
I agree. And I think that teamwork and that collaboration and that patient and family centered focus is so important to make sure that people are supported from all the sides.
Yes.
And I know as an education facilitator and teaching other healthcare people about hospice palliative care now, it's made me go back and reflect again on my own values, my own thoughts, my own feelings about my mortality, about my loved one's mortality, just about death and dying, dying and death in general. And I think it's important to reflect, especially if you are a healthcare professional in this field, about your own values and feelings when it comes to dying and death, and reflect on how they affect your practice.
Absolutely.
Because we're not always aware about those little things that we say or how we say them. And I think that's important. And we need to give space to those who aren't quite as ready as we are to have these conversations, to come to it in their own time when possible.
Agreed.
I think the other thing is that we all do our own advanced care planning. We need to, you know, we need to practice what we preach.
Yes.
And make sure that we're having those conversations with our families, because it's good practice for when we have to speak to a patient or a family member about these topics.
It absolutely is. And I'm similar to you, Laura, too, where I will bring up those topics, you know, whether it be at the dinner table or a family event. And knowing my family, they're usually a few drinks in and they're not wanting to hear it. But you know, I think it is important to have those conversations, because I realized too that even in my family, I don't have a lot of, there's not really any nurses or doctors. There's a few, but there's not a lot of people who are in the medical field or in my type of work. So these are, I think, important to have conversations now, because I can very much see it later being a crisis. Right.
And
I want to be able to prevent that for my family.
Agreed. Same in my family. It's a little bit of a trailblazer, a little bit of, you know, we're sort of the representative of the hospice palliative care world in our own lives. I know for myself, I think of it this way. We're only born once, but technically we are dying every day of our lives. We just don't always know when and how it's going to come.
That's right.
And I think it deserves the same amount of preparation, discussion, forethought, and respect that any other big decision in our life gets.
Yeah.
Bucket lists, I've always said, should not be left until you're told you're dying.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think our main message is that you prepare for the worst, hope for the best, and it's okay to say the word death.
Yes. Brilliantly put, Laura. Really well put.
Any other closing thoughts, Jen, before we wrap up our conversation today?
No, you know what? I don't think I can beat that one, Laura. That was a perfect way to close that. And I just want to thank you so much for having me on here. I absolutely love any opportunity to have these conversations. And I look forward to doing more.
Thank you, Jen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Laura and Jen. That was a very heartfelt and very informative conversation. Very much appreciated. And thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Linda.
Thank you.